Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University. This is the fourth Yale University Libraries Preservation Lecture. We're grateful to Jack, Class of 47, and Betsy O'Neill for sponsoring this lecture. The speaker is Mary M. Brooks, a consultant and conservator of textiles. After reading English at Cambridge University, Mary worked in the book world before moving into management consultancy and gaining a diploma in management studies. She then developed her long-term interest in textiles by taking the postgraduate Diploma in Textile Conservation, Textile Conservation Center, and has worked as conservator and curator in museums in the U.S., Europe, and England. Exhibitions curated include the award-winning exhibition Stop the Rot at York Castle Museum, which aimed to raise public awareness of heritage conservation. She was head of studies and research at the Textile Conservation Center and subsequently reader and program leader for their MA museum and galleries. She now works independently, undertaking conservation and museum projects, as well as teaching conservation and museology in universities in the United Kingdom and abroad. Mary has a particular interest in the contribution that object-based research and conservation approaches can make to the wider interpretation and presentation of cultural artifacts. Other research areas include 17th century embroideries, X-radiography of textiles and dress, regenerated protein fibers, and educational methodologies for teaching and learning in conservation and museum studies. Her talk is entitled Cassandra Calling, Conservation Pasts, Present, and Futures.
I'm Bobby Paulette, and I'm director of the Preservation Department for the library here at Yale. It is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the fourth preservation lecture in our series. Today's lecture is sponsored by Jack O'Neill, who's class of 47, and his wife, Betsy O'Neill, so we much appreciate their support. I'm delighted to introduce today's speaker, Mary Brooks. Mary read English at Cambridge and worked in the book world before moving into management consultancy and received a diploma in management studies. She then developed her long-term interest in textiles by taking a postgraduate diploma in textile conservation. She has worked as a conservator and a curator in museums in the U.S., Europe, and England, and curated exhibitions including an award-winning exhibition, Stop the Rot, at York Castle Museum. I would really have been interested in seeing that one. Great title. This was aimed at raising public awareness of heritage conservation. She was head of studies and research at the Textile Conservation Center and subsequently reader and program leader for the MA Museum and Galleries, which are now works independently undertaking conservation and museum projects, as well as teaching conservation and museology in universities in the United Kingdom and abroad. She is honorary research fellow at the University of Glasgow and visiting lecturer at the Universities of York and of Durham, to name just a few of her current posts. Her research areas include embroideries, textiles, and dress, and educational methodologies for teaching and learning in conservation and museum studies. Of particular interest is the contribution that object-based research and conservation approaches can make to the wider interpretation and presentation of cultural artifacts. Her talk today will explore the changing relationships between conservators, conservation in the public, and scholars in our postmodern digital world of replicas and multiples. Please welcome Mary Brooks.
Well, thank you very much, Bobby, for inviting me, and Christine McCarthy for starting the original idea. It's lovely to be with you this afternoon. I also want to thank the sponsors on the O'Neills on my own behalf, and thank you for coming on such a glorious spring afternoon to explore with me some ideas about the past of conservation, its presence, and its possible futures. Can I just check you can all hear me properly? Yeah, great, okay. And I really wanted to start by just explaining a little about why I think this was something that's useful to explore in terms of the current position of conservation, a profession which I've been privileged to practice as a conservator and as an educator. And I'm rather saddened and concerned by some of the changes I've seen in my short conservation lifetime. I think we're in a somewhat paradoxical position at the moment. There is, in England at least, and I suspect in other countries as well, a sense of loss, of slippage in the status of conservation and of threats to its future. And at the same time, a sense of new energy in an enriched understanding of an expanded role for heritage conservation in enriching people's lives and experiences, and maybe, possibly, enabling greater understanding of our own cultures and those of others. And it's this gap that I really want to try and explore a little today. And by its very nature, this is a messy subject. It isn't a neat, rational argument. So I hope you'll bear with me as I explore various aspects which I think are significant and useful. And I hope you will find them interesting too. And I look forward to hearing your comments. So why did I start with the mythic story of Cassandra as a framework? Well, I'm not claiming Cassandra's powers of foretelling the future. And I wouldn't really want them. As I expect you know, she acquired the gift of prophecy from Apollo. But later on, he got some rather fancy ideas. And when Cassandra rejected his advances, Apollo cursed her by depriving her prophecies of the power to persuade anybody. And amongst her ignored and unwelcome prophecies was the prophecy of the fall of Troy. She was renowned for her beauty, but thought to be mad. And she was locked away by her father, King Priam of Troy. And the different myths tell of her abduction by Ajax the Lesser from her refuge in Athena's temple, the twins she unwillingly bore to Agamemnon, and her brutal murder by Clytemnestra. It's an unhappy story all round, and one which has inspired many paintings, not, it has to be said, all of them good, and dramatists from Aeschylus to Shakespeare. And I was very pleased to see a reference to Troilus and Cressida outside the room today, because Troilus is particularly rude about Cassandra, diminishing and dismissing her as a foolish, dreaming, superstitious girl. Well, I hope I'm not that. But I'm using Cassandra's story here as a reminder that it's sometimes important to look at unpalatable and unwelcome facts and to explore them in order to avoid becoming like those who could hear her truths but not believe them and certainly not reflect and act on them. So I want to start by looking very briefly at the present situation, and I've just put together some fairly familiar clippings from newspapers here, and I'm sure I don't need to remind you of the threats to cultural heritage conservation from the current financial crisis, budget cuts, reduced staffing levels, closing courses, the rising costs of achieving a professional conservation education, increasing difficulty in finding a permanent post, and sadly, no high salaries. And the UK Museums Association did a survey in July 2011. It's just embarking on its second one, looking at the impact of cuts on UK museums, which have really noted that museums which have suffered a 25% cut or more, over 60% of those have cut back on public events, half have reduced opening hours, and 85% have cut staff. That's across the board, but it has a disproportionate effect on small conservation departments. And these frontline activities, if I can call them that, are merely the visible evidence of the difficulties we are facing in enabling and encouraging decision makers to value cultural heritage, and within that, heritage conservation. And just one example here from Europe. The European Commission has so far excluded cultural heritage from Horizon 2020, which is their big funding program for research and innovation, although many museums and conservation bodies are petitioning them against it. So right from the bottom to the top, it feels like slippage at the moment. And there's also the continued question of helping the understanding of heritage conservation, not just by the public, but by our fellow professionals. And this is something which I was really surprised to read, and I was just reading the English Colour Supplements on Sunday, weekend before I left, and there's an account of Bergen's Whale Hall in a novel written by Kathleen Jamie called Sightlines. And there is an excerpt of the section on the conservation of the whales. And the project director is quoted as saying, "Conservation, though, once you've established the protocol, it's just glorified housework." Now, I hope that, unlike Cassandra, who I think really didn't have a sense of humour, I am capable of seeing a joke. But this is the sort of joke that really can misfire, can be misquoted, and it maybe is an indicator of underlying assumptions and attitudes. And it's this sort of background that I think illuminates the trajectory of the Conservation Centre of the National Museums and Galleries on Merseyside, which was set up in 1995. This is one of the best known examples in England of enabling public access to conservation practice. It was an innovative centre which aimed to enable visitors to gain an understanding of the principles and processes of conservation and the meaning in the enrichment it could add to their viewing of objects in the museum's collections. They had a multi-layered communication approach, an exhibition, live video links, talking to the conservators, laboratory tours, hands-on sessions, surgeries for objects, all the things that you would expect. It won Museum of the Year in 1998 and the International Institute of Conservation's Keck Award in the same year. Public displays at the Conservation Centre closed to visitors on Friday the 17th of December 2010, following government cuts, but also choices made within the institution. And I want to be very clear that I'm not disparaging or undervaluing the many initiatives conservators have made and are making to influence, engage, celebrate, communicate and develop our work. There are exciting new projects. The British Museum has the new World Conservation Exhibition Centre, and you here have the Yale Centre for Conservation and Preservation. As well as such physical expressions of confidence in the value of conservation, there have been powerful advocacy activities and publications, such as the 2008 Demos pamphlet, It's a Material World, Caring for the Public Realm, and the 2009 Salzburg Declaration on the Conservation and Preservation of Cultural Heritage. Conservators have also shown they're able to think beyond the individual object, the collection, and the institution, to analyse conservation problems on a national and even international scale. In 2011, ICROM, the International Centre for Study of the Preservation and Restoration of Cultural Property in Rome, together with UNESCO, undertook a study of museum storage. Your own survey, with a sampling frame of over 35,000 collecting institutions, resulted in the publication A Public Trust at Risk, the Heritage Health Index Report on the State of Americans' Collections. This concluded that immediate action was needed to prevent the loss of 190 million artifacts which were in need of conservation treatment. Conservators have also demonstrated their ability to share their love of objects and the making of meaning through them, and engaging others in the pleasures of caring for the material past, for educational and social benefit. Many projects have demonstrated their ability to create real individual and community value. And I'm just showing you here an example from the London Archaeological Archive and Research Centre at the Museum of London, their volunteer inclusion project, which aimed to improve storage and accessibility within the collections at the same time as involving an inclusive mix of volunteers of different ages, different backgrounds and different social situations. And there was a very active program for the volunteers with e-learning projects, workshops, development of social skills and so forth, as well as working with the collections, handling heritage material and contributing to the preservation of the objects through storage projects. So why does conservation as a profession and a practice within cultural heritage seem to be in danger of slipping off the agenda? I would love to think I was wrong about that, but I'm afraid I don't think I am. So I want to explore a little bit now some ideas about notions of the past and the museum, which I think may give us some insights into the problematic present and possible futures of conservation. The past is not always seen as a good thing. This advice at the top, the whole continent Europe is an overblown, dusty museum, comes from a travel website advising travellers to avoid Europe. So that's where I come from, bringing the dust. The link between dust and the museum is surprisingly and rather depressingly persistent. And there's another of my favourite quotes, this time from the Singapore News. Dusty old specimens tucked away in drawers. That's what museums are about. And the Museum of the Isles in Scotland uses this trope to differentiate itself from, quote, the traditional image of the dusty museum. They're saying they're nothing like that. And I should explain, in fairness to the Grant Museum at UCL in London, this photograph was taken during building works. But seriously, in his famous essay on museums, the German philosopher Adorno explored the links, linguistic and psychological, between the museum and the mausoleum. And you don't have to look too far before you find the word museum being used, and I'm quoting Mark O'Neill from Scotland now, as a byword for the obsolete or defunct, for the dusty, lifeless, and boring. Despite the protestations of museum workers that our institutions are really vibrant and friendly, dust-free, and full of life. So, museum conservators are implicated in this negative image of the past. One might almost say tainted. But for us, it's an active and transformative engagement rather than immurement in a mausoleum. There is a deep link between conservators' ideas of themselves and the formulation of their role as linking the past and the future. Cesare Abrandi's theory of restoration, published in 1963, is one of the founding philosophical frameworks of the profession. He describes the moment of intervention as, quote, the methodological moment in which the object is appreciated in its material form and its historical and aesthetic duality, with a view to transmitting it to the future. This position continues to find expression. The 2002, and I'm sorry, this turns into alphabet soup, but bear with me. It's the European Confederation of Conservation Restorers Organization, which is commonly known as ECHO. Their professional guidelines describes the role of conservators in ensuring that material and cultural patrimony is to be passed on to coming generations. And your own American Institute for Conservation talks about melding art with science, so conservation professionals protect our heritage, preserve our legacy, and ultimately save our treasures for generations to come. So conservators are this linking point between the past, dusty or not, and the future, unknown. But we need to make this a positive. And I think this pivotal agency in maintaining the tangible artifact as a physical, emotional, and spiritual link, bridging a forgotten and possibly neglectful past and a sometimes threatening future, may be best expressed in poetry. So we have Eliot's Chinese Jar, transcending time, moving perpetually in its stillness. And at the risk of seeming cliched, Keats's meditation on a Grecian urn remains an eloquent testimony to the object, linking the past with the future. When old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain in midst of other woe than ours. But however strong the force of this vision of time out of time, conservators know perfectly well that objects do not transcend time without care and attention. Jars break, vases fall, paper yellows, wood cracks, textiles fade. And it takes another poet, Peter Redgrave, to be rather more realistic about the effects of moth on a tapestry. This is from his poem called Tapestry Moths. It was the tapestry moths that ate the colours like the light, nimping over the hangings, voracious cameras, and reproduced across their wings the great scenes they consumed, carrying the conception of artists. Decay is both our challenge and our raison d'etre, and is the inevitable legacy of living in a material world. But it is the past which we have to take through to the future in a constructive way. Museums and conservators are dedicated to overcoming this decay, even if only temporarily. Entropy will win in the end. And I want to think for a little about what this means for the operation of time in a museum. Museums can be seen as machines for the destruction of time. That is, they act to create a world which is outside contemporaneous time. And it seems as if MasterCard might have been onto this same idea when they used the headline, "Feeling lost in time, priceless," in one of their famous, or rather infamous, priceless advertisements. Now, I am neither a philosopher nor an anthropologist, so I'm treading lightly here. But I do think it is interesting to think about Levi-Strauss's famous observation in The Savage Mind that ritual is a machine for the destruction of time, and think about that in the context of museums. Famously, Levi-Strauss characterized the function of ritual as that as overcoming time, and I'm quoting now, "Historical rites bring the past into the present." He used the examples of the Chirunga, worked or unworked ovals of stone or wood, representing a specific ancestor, which were preserved by the Western and Northern Arandra in Australia. Although the Chirunga were hidden away, concealed and separated from daily life, they were, and I'm quoting again here, periodically taken out to be inspected and handled, and on these occasions they are polished, greased and coloured, and prayers and incantations are addressed to them. The Chirunga were thus cared for both spiritually and physically in a process somewhat akin to the processes of storage and conservation and interpretation which we know in modern Western museums. Levi-Strauss's point here is that the Chirunga were the past materially present. Interestingly, he then compares the Arunda's use of the Chirunga with Western practices, but not, as might be expected, with artifacts in museums which contain embedded information, but with documents in archives which are carriers of information, and I'll come back to that distinction later. Nevertheless, Levi-Strauss acknowledged the importance of both the data and the physicality of the archival materials, arguing this gave a physical existence to history, for in them alone is the contradiction of a completed past and a present in which it survives, surmounted. So we have this idea of past and the present coming together again. And I'd like you now to look at the strap lines on these advertisements on the far side of Victorian visitor experience. The famous recreation of Viking York visited via a time capsule, and a museum also in York which featured one of the earliest recreated Victorian streets. The visitor is invited to step into the world of yesterday today, undertake Britain's best journey through time, or wander through the streets of bygone Britain. All these worlds, whether filled with real things or with reconstructions, are modelled as worlds out of present time, offering an experience which differs from that of everyday life. Marketing departments may know more than we think. Examining models of time can inform understanding of acceptance or rejection of the impact of the passage of time on artifacts and how conservators engage with time's physical manifestations. Anthropologists such as Durkheim and Gell have argued that time should be viewed as a social construct. And the idea of destruction of time in a museum can be taken further by using Gell's ideas of time anthropology. What he says is the manifold ways in which time becomes salient in human affairs. And in his critique of Levi-Strauss's model of time, Gell argues that, and I'm quoting again, "The illusion of time travel engendered by the contemplation of ancient objects is just that, an illusion, but one that is central to ritual performance. And he describes psychological time, which he considers is good for subjective processes, but not for objective ones, and also physical time, which is good for objective processes, but not subjective ones. And I think this is an interesting insight for helping us understand the contradictions within the operation of time, or rather times, in the museum. So in the broadest terms, I would suggest to you that the museum is offering an experience of psychological time to the visitor, a dream time. But museums also have to deal with physical time in terms of the objects in their care. And decay, which is the result of the passage of physical time, therefore becomes this contested area. It slips between these different time states, and it's in this space that conservators and curators have to make decisions about the preservation of objects, decisions which will affect how they are valued and given meaning, and how they are understood by the museum visitor, and the form in which we will leave them for future generations. And Geller notes that it is, of course, the effects of time and not time itself which are destroyed. But nevertheless, this idea of overcoming time is a very powerful one for museums and conservators. And I think it does underlie the overt social, cultural, legal, and financial reasons why we invest time and energy and expertise into object conservation. And sometimes these are unspoken assumptions. But usually, unless we're dealing with archaeological material or certain types of antique sculpture, imperfections, incompleteness, losses are generally considered unacceptable. Surfaces should be smooth, often reflective. Dust again, should be removed over and over again. Missing elements should be put back physically, if not aesthetically. And as Endersaw put it, work goes into the sustenance of an object over time. It is cared for, cleaned and polished, to bestow upon it an illusion of permanence, to keep at bay the spectres of waste and decay. Responding to the physical effects of time is thus not just a physical issue. It reflects assumptions about the degree to which the history of the object is allowed to be evident in its physical presentation in the museum. This may involve minimizing the evidence of decay in the past. Although conservators are now much more sympathetic to the idea of retaining evidence of major changes, which are thought to be significant in telling an object's history. And I do think we have to consider the West's attitude to decay in that most personal of sites, our own bodies, and how that impacts on the degree of decay in terms of the impact of time that we're prepared to admit to in a museum object. And it's here that certain artists' enthusiastic embrace of decay as meaningful and even beautiful can be illuminating. It is relatively easy to list artworks where experimental or careless technical practices resulted in rapid, if not sensational, decay, and hence challenging decisions about preservation and presentation. And I'm sure you're all aware of the sort of problems that have appeared with Etty's choice of paint and varnish, and Gabo's use of cellulose nitrate. Joseph Beuys's wool suit has been so damaged by moth it can no longer be displayed, and Damien Hirst's shark has been replaced at least once. But some artists actively choose to explore decay in their work, making degradation part of their making of meaning. Both Douglas Fishburne and Andrew Goldsworthy have explored ideas of time through their deliberate exploitation of material which is bound to decay. Fishburne is an installation artist who has created a series of works consisting of great heaps of bananas piled up in public places. Sadly, I missed the one in London by about a day. I was so cross. But the sight of these huge yellow piles stops people dead in their tracks, as does the intense sweet smell. And they're intended as a physical representation of perishable natural wealth, and hence a critique of global consumerism, greed, and violence. Goldsworthy's Midsummer Snowballs were just that, balls of snow, each weighing about a ton, large and startlingly unexpected when placed on a street in the City of London in high summer. These were just loaded with natural materials gathered from around his Scottish home. And as they melted, the rural debris became part of the urban landscape. It's actually quite interesting. Some people got really, really cross with these things. They coming out of the office at the end of a day and suddenly there's this huge pile of sticks and people actually kind of physically attack some of them, which is quite interesting. But my point here is that transience is the essence of these works, and they are a kind of speeded up version of the decay to which all museum objects inevitably subject. And so they were bringing future degradation very abruptly into the present. And we are resistant to decay. We do preserve, restore, conserve. And intervening in an object implicitly and explicitly suggests that it is in some way failing to meet what we think it should be, its ideal state. And it is useful to think very clearly and openly about the motivations behind these interventions. Is it to enhance historical understanding, match an aesthetic ideal, highlight an aspect of the object's biography, achieve physical stability? But it's important also to remember that as well as being an act of interpretation, preservation can be seen as a political act. It is controlling as much as protecting the object by managing its physical state. And as we all know, objects, despite our devotion to them, can be very difficult things. They are naturally messy, intellectually and physically. They're big, awkward, tiny, fiddly, fragile, delicate, mobile. I'm sure you can all add your own words here. And the problem is bad enough when we're dealing with a unique object, but it gets even more complex when we deal with objects which I'm today characterizing as multiples. Now, I think the idea of the unique is very important in the museum. The only, the oldest, the biggest, the smallest, the whatever. It helps the museum define itself, but it also is very useful in marketing terms. So in a very proper postmodern manner, I looked up unique and museums on Google, something I would always stop my students doing. And I found this definition on the wiki for a museum, which I thought was very interesting in framing this distinction between the unique and the multiple. A museum is distinguished by a collection of often unique objects that forms the core of its activities for exhibitions, education, research, etc. I guess conservation is etc. This differentiates it from an archive or library where the contents may be more paper-based, replaceable, and less exhibition-orientated. I thought you'd like that one. So, this cheerfully ignores the long tradition of cast making in the museum, and I'm just showing you a recent replica made in the British Museum. Their facsimile service is now part of the Conservation Department. But it is something that I think is interestingly pointed up by the case of libraries. And I'm just showing you here various reconstructions of the Alexandra Library, both real and virtual, testimonies to the power of the book. And I'm very much aware I'm standing here and I'm not a librarian, although I did have the great privilege of working for a year as an intern in the British Library in its old Bloomsbury site, where one of my tasks in the rare books department was to check booksellers' and auctioneers' catalogues for editions of printed books which were not yet in the library. The library might already have many editions of the same book, but they wanted every edition. And I have to say, I found that quite puzzling at the time. But it was Walter Benjamin in his fascinating essay, Unpacking My Library, who helped me understand the notion of the one book and the many book. Not only books, but also copies of books have their fates. And clearly, as far as we're concerned, it's not just the collector or the reader, but also the librarian and the conservator who control the destiny of the book. And I imagine if, like me, you love the touch, the weight, the smell of the book, whether old or new, and find parting with them almost impossible, you will sympathise with Sir John Soane. This is his library. He was a prime example of the sufferer from book disease. In his essay, Hooked on Books, Nicholas Savage describes Soane's library flowing, and I quote, like invisible lava depositing fragments in underground pockets throughout the house. Sometimes these deposits erupted in outcrops of glazed shelving, but more often they remained hidden behind cupboard doors. but all were, quote, vessels of memory, potent triggers of feeling, and association in his mind. And he was a collector of multiples. He had more than one copy of the same book. Well, the book does help us think about where value resides, because the text has multiple lives and nowadays can be separated from the physical carrier and increasingly has a digital life removed from the material world. And I'm just putting here a chained library against a picture of someone walking down the street with their Kindle. And I have to confess, I've just bought one. But uniqueness here has shifted location. And Microsoft predict that by the year 2020, the primary dictionary definition of the word book will be, quote, a substantial piece of writing commonly displayed on a computer or other personal viewing device. Now, they have got a particular position to maintain, but it's an interesting point. And as I was working on this lecture, the news came through that the Bodleian Library and the Biblioteca Apostolica at the Vaticana are planning to digitize 1.5 million pages of Greek and Hebrew manuscripts and early books. In England, we've already seen the practical impact of the digital and the virtual as public libraries remodel themselves as discovery centres, highlighting digital resources as much as books. And I've just put in here the advertising slogans that my local library is using, and the physical book is clearly becoming less significant to them. Now, don't get me wrong, there are fantastic benefits in accessing the virtual world. I love it that I can access early English books online, search museum collections, look at objects, examine them in detail, explore related artifacts, visit World Heritage sites, all without leaving my desk. And museums are becoming more and more sophisticated in their use of the virtual world. Oops, now we're going to get this. We did earlier. Bear with me. This is a project by Sheffield Museums and Sheffield Hallam University, and to me it's extraordinary. To the next generation it will probably seem normal or even rather boring. But the technology is enabling incredible focus on a single object, and you could probably see more than you could see by looking at the object in a museum case. It enables access to objects that are too fragile to handle, cannot be brought into display. But there are losses as well as gains. We can't touch, we can't smell, but then we can't normally touch or smell in the museum. And presumably, haptic technology will overcome the touch problem sooner or later. But there is, I think, a denial of the materiality of the object which we do have to think about and which is significant for conservators. As Miriam Clavier has pointed out, for us, knowledge is contained in their very fabric of an object, a source not just of physical evidence and technological information, but also of changes, repairs, and alterations. The object biography that often gives people a way into understanding an object's history, and hence wider narratives of culture. The social conversational context of the museum is replaced by a different context, possibly individual, possibly shared, possibly educational. This visual image is curiously outside time or space, and I guess you could argue, back to Gell's terms, that this is psychological time. The image can be summoned up at any time, in any place, sometimes deliberately, sometimes through random browsing. Is this akin to suddenly discovering something beautiful in the corner of a museum gallery? But to me, something of the specialness of the museum context is lost. This could be any image pulled up anywhere on Google. Its very perfection can impact on how people understand objects and their complex effects of their passage through time. And for me personally, I think we're only at the beginning of understanding what impact the digitized object might have on conservation practice. How might it change visitors' expectations? Will it mean that visitors who already find it difficult to read and understand the real thing find it even more difficult when they are used to seeing the digital image, when they're used to being able to zoom in and zoom out, when they're used to being able to control the image not peer at something in the back of a hopefully not dusty case? Will it mean that objects need to be conserved to a much higher finish so that the high quality multiple images can be made? Will these seductive images come to surpass the real object and become more desirable, meaning that less emphasis is placed on objects and display? You don't need to see the thing if you can look at it on the website. I'm going to leave those questions hanging in the air and come back to thinking about how we can use this technology as conservators to communicate conservation. Now, hopefully I won't lose everything. Perfect. Conservators have been really active in using traditional modes of communication to explore philosophy and practices of conservation. And there are many examples, and I've just shown you a few here. Time Will Tell from Yale University Gallery, British Museums, Conservation in Focus, and the Historic Royal Palaces Ask the Conservators programme. And Simon Kane, in 2002, did a study of the representation of conservation on museum websites and found it to be either absent or deeply buried. Now, the web is alive with conservation, both on and off museum websites. Searching YouTube for heritage conservation gives over 3,000 hits, and I think we may be adding another one this afternoon. Sometimes it's very simple, just giving details of the treatment of an iconic object, such as the silver swan in Bowes. Sometimes it's actively engaging the public with making decisions, as in the case of the website which Manchester Art Gallery built around the Getty Sirens painting. They actively had a poll asking visitors whether this painting should be restored, as well as a timeline showing the work of the project. Lots of institutions, this is the National Museums at Liverpool, are using the detective story as a way of engaging the public, engaging children in understanding processes of deterioration and the processes of conservation. Here you get a chance to identify and stop the agents of deterioration, and you get the opportunity to gather evidence using scientific techniques. And Canadian Conservation Institute, CCI, has done something a little similar with their preservation quests, interactive game to test conservation understanding. So there's all these things going on, enabling a greater engagement, enabling visitors to museums, labs, rather than just one person looking through one window into one lab. You can see ongoing conservation wherever you are. Some institutions are putting their full conservation reports on the web. Now, I think this is a very radical step to crossing public and professional boundaries. And personally, I welcome it, but I know some people have concerns. It does broaden public access, not just to the object, but to the associated knowledge generated through the conservation process. And it goes a very long way to overcome the problem of the disassociation of knowledge, which conservator Anne French of Manchester's Whitworth Art Gallery has identified as the 10th agent of destruction. All these initiatives show how conservators are able to share and deepen knowledge and understanding of conservation by using the web. There are, of course, access, costs, and sustainability issues. Websites like museum exhibitions need maintenance and refreshing. It is also worth noting the virtual world is very labile. Websites change and disappear, but it is a powerful tool. It can enrich engagement with objects. It can help bridge this gap between past and future without falling down into the dust pit of the museum. So I just want to close by just looking at cultural value in a more schematic way. I dare say you're very familiar with diagrams illustrating cultural value, but I particularly like this one, which comes from the Dutch Institute for Cultural Heritage, their report, Knowledge for Movable Heritage. And I like it because it engages with access, use, and development, and sees that as an interlocking process. And for all the problems that I've been raising and the questions I've been trying to identify about what the digital world might mean in terms of looking and engaging with objects, It does have huge potential. Conservatives have an intense relationship with objects, seeking to understand the evidence they contain and elucidate and preserve latent information through investigation and intervention. And we have radically changed our attitudes to public engagement. So this is very much coming together in a new and different way, I think. The public has increasingly become an essential partner in safeguarding our shared cultural heritage. And surely this is where the future lies for conservation, as an enabling discipline, a culturally meaningful activity which adds to pleasure and understanding of visitors, whether they're in the museum or somewhere else, and enhances knowledge for researchers, whether they're in the museum or somewhere else, whilst using all the resources available. Openly acknowledging the role of conservators as agents in cultural making of meaning and having an active contribution to contemporary cultural values and social life is potentially a democratic process. In practical terms, we do need to reflect on how others see us and how we want to be perceived and valued. We want to think about what sort of conservators we want to be. What sort of training will the next generation need to cope with this changing world and the changing demands? We do need to have a balance between the technical skills and understanding and our other inputs into cultural meaning. In both the real and the virtual world, we need to continue our efforts to build a creative, constructive conservation profession, capable of convincing colleagues in museums, politicians and policymakers of the value of what we do. We do need to attract high-caliber entrants through well-funded education programmes and offer appropriate prospects and rewards. And for me, enhancing conservators' potential for leadership and management is vital. And throughout all this, we need to collaborate and communicate with bodies and disciplines outside our profession and continue to engage with the public so we demonstrate the contribution that we can make in preserving and making tangible and intangible cultural heritage meaningful. And I just want to finish with this quote from the Demos report, It's a Material World. Jones and Holden argue that conservation principles and practice are central not only to culture and heritage, but also to the well-being of society. They propose active public engagement in the process of prioritising conservation decision-making. This values underpinning conservation practice and could inform a wide range of activities reflecting not only the past, but the diversity of world cultures and their living practices and evolution, as well as their material heritage. So Sam and John write, conservation is about refreshing and renewing culture and heritage in ways that reflect and contribute to society's values, thereby making a statement about value to others and a statement about the present to the future. So I would like to close by thanking those colleagues with whom I've had many stimulating discussions over the years and to thank you for listening. Thank you very much.
Ask Mary. There'll be opportunities also at the
reception,
but if there's a question that you want.
Stunned into silence. Well, actually, I was curious, one of the things that is being promoted are conservation labs behind glass,
yeah,
so that the public can get a good view of what's going on. And I was wondering what your opinion was of such a setup.
And I've never worked in a lab with a permanent window. I have done conservation in public. And I know how unnerving it can be. And I know that I think I have a reference with me. People have written about this from the conservator's perspective. I think it can have value, but it's not a free ride. It needs to be managed and set up. Otherwise, you can look through the window and you can see a load of empty benches because the conservators have taken the things around the corner to do the things they want to do. Or they're reading a book or they're staring at a black box with a tube coming out of it. And it's not visually exciting, it's not necessarily comprehensible. And at the Liverpool Centre, they did have visual access to the lab, but they also set up a system whereby people could talk to a conservator doing a project by some sort of sound link. And that's great, as long as you build into the schedule the value of that public education, and you're not expecting the conservator to be able to produce the same number of objects for the same exhibition deadline. So I think it really has to be thought through. It's not just a question of making a hole in the wall, and it has to be managed as an ongoing activity, which is a benefit, and like all benefits, has a cost. And I know my mother reminded me of this the other day, because I was saying, oh, I didn't know about conservation until I did such and such, and my embroidery teacher told me, blah, blah, blah. She said, I know when you decided you wanted to do this. And we went to a Tudor house in a city in East Anglia, and somebody was sitting in the hall conserving the tapestries. And she said, I knew that was what you needed to do then, but it took you a very long time to get there. So I think it can have all sorts of other powerful impacts. But I think in terms of what the public get out of it, in terms of what conservators get out of it, because sometimes it's really stimulating talking to the public, but it has to be managed, because otherwise it's not going to work. And then it becomes like, oh, well, conservators are no good at talking to the public, they're no good, they don't get the objects done, the people don't understand what they're talking. And then it turns into a big hole instead of a window. And we want windows.
You talk about pressure on conservators to make the object look like time has had no effect on it. And then the other, another aspect was the expectation on the part of the public that the object should look like the nice, cleaned up, colorful computer version that they can see on the web. Is there a way to bring the two of them together so that the conservator can focus on slowing or stopping the deterioration of the object, and the nice, shiny, visual one is right next to it on the monitor?
I think there is, but one of the things that I'm concerned about is that in the real world, I think we've reached a much better point of actually being able to say, look, this object looks this way because of what it's been through, and we don't want to make it look, you know, shiny, smooth, whatever. But I'm concerned that the you know, maybe the digital world can't really have pressure, but the force of the digital will bring us back to that point where the shiny and the smooth and the complete and the colourful become dominant again. And as I say, I think I'm still very much thinking my way through some of this, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it. But I think we've got to start thinking about that very clearly within our own community in order to be able to say to people who are designing websites, people who are putting whole museum collections online, okay, this is what we want the object to look like. And I think that brings us back to another issue about how honest we are with the public about how it is the object in the museum has arrived at the state it has arrived at. Because there is sometimes, I think, an element, I don't know, words like deceit and concealment are strong words, but I think people don't know. People are increasingly divorced from an understanding of materials and making. So they just assume that, you know, every 18th century vase looks like that, every Renaissance tapestry looks like that, because that's what they see in the museum. And so I think we need to unpick that a little. And one of the things I learned from Stop the Rot was that people really found broken, damaged objects easier to relate to than the objects we had spent painful months, years conserving. And I think I will continue to reflect on that conundrum for the rest of my life, but I learned a lot from that experience. So I'm not sure if that's an answer, but hopefully it raises some of the other issues I think we need to reflect on.
Yeah. To reverse that treatment. And I think increasingly, I think we all here are thinking actually we could be communicating what should that look like? I mean, is that the traditional report that we were, taught to make?
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I think it is going to be one of the things we have to look at, and how we write those reports. I have this nightmare vision of conservators writing what they think of as the real report, and then this kind of pap version that goes on the web. And I don't think we want that sort of disassociation. But I can see there's all sorts of legal issues. I can see there's health and safety issues. I can see there's real concerns about, oh my God, somebody might read this and, children, don't do this at home. I think it's potentially really exciting, and I think it can relocate objects with source communities and give people an understanding of what conservation means, but only if we manage it and we engage with it. And that means we have to think about it very fast, I think, and also think about how we're teaching the next generation to write reports. So big change. I think big change, but I haven't got a roadmap for that one yet.
And where are
the middle tier.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk, and I think it's a common thread throughout the lectures of educating the next generation of conservators. But there's a generation of conservators already out.
Yeah.
Out here, doing
work. One of the things.
Aren't in the position necessarily to make some of the changes that you need.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on that.
One of the things that happened in England about, it must be nearly 10 years ago now, was there was a realisation in the museum community that exactly that situation you described was happening for museum curators. And they were getting museum directors being parachuted in from other disciplines, other professions, because they weren't getting people coming up through the profession. And they did set up, with the help of a very generous charitable educational trust, a whole series of educational management development challenge programs to absolutely address that issue. And one of the things that I so wanted to do at Textile Conservation Centre and never did, for obvious reasons, was have something parallel for conservators. And then I thought, well, actually, no, we don't want conservators in a different box. We want conservators in the same box, because I don't think it should be different trees. I think it should be one tree. But I do think that professional development programs for that tier coming up to take the big jobs is very important. And I've no notion, I'd love to know what they're doing in AIC and American Museum Association and other places to address that issue. Sorry, yes? Conservatives should be totally involved in fundraising, and they should be making it do what they want it to do. My PhD, well, I did it for the hell of it, so that when people say to me, "Oh, is it Mrs. or Miss?" I can go, "No, it's Doctor." In terms of my life as a conservator, absolutely no difference at all. I don't think it makes any difference to people in the conservation profession. When I'm working in universities where I'm actually, they don't think of me as a conservator, never mind think of me anything to do with those nasty, dangerous, soft, floppy, pink, feminine stuff textiles, they just take it for granted you've got a doctorate. So it's a very odd thing. It means a lot to me. I sweated for it, but I think in professional terms, certainly in England, it doesn't make any difference to your salary or your grade, but it might make a difference to how you're seen and how you're able to negotiate with funders, other bodies, other people. I think it makes a big difference if you're going to go and talk to science department, chemistry department, engineers, MBA people. I think we need to use every little scrap we can muster. Sorry.